Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Well, springtime is in full effect here in Northern California. The rains are kind of just tailing off, finally, after a massive rain year. It was raining when I talked to today's guest, Yana Selman, so there's some kind of like rainy background noise throughout the recording, but that's what it was, just rain coming down on my studio during the recording. I met Yana, I guess maybe like last year at an international meeting on statistical climatology, and thought she had some interesting ideas on climate extremes in particular. And she's made a career out of studying extremes from pretty early days in graduate school, and then throughout her career, not just trying to quantify extremes, but really trying to understand how extremes in heat, atmospheric rivers, precipitation, things like this are represented or not represented in climate models, and what kinds of processes are driving that and how best to represent them in climate models. And with something like extremes, it's not a straightforward process. You do have changes in circulation patterns. Yana's looked quite a lot at atmospheric blocking systems, but the presence of a blocking system isn't by itself enough to really generate a massive heat wave. You have to have other kinds of conditions, in particular on the land surface, to actually generate, for example, a heat wave. So we talk about that quite a bit. She's also had a fascinating background. Grew up in communist East Germany in what sounds like, to me at least, a very sort of surprisingly idyllic childhood, but then moved around, like a lot of academics do, to North America, both to the US, Canada, Germany, and now settling in at Norway in the Center for International Climate Research, or CICERO. I've had a few comments on iTunes on the podcast, which is great. I had one that was pretty interesting to me. It was a nice review, but it said that they would have liked to have seen more balance in gender in particular. And I've tried fairly hard. I mean, it hasn't been hard, but I've tried to maintain some kind of gender diversity. And I went through, and I think I've posted about 40 or so episodes. And of those, 21 or so have been with men and 18 have been with women. After today, it'll be more like, you know, 21 and 19. And after the next, it'll be more like 21 and 20. So I feel like I actually have fairly good gender diversity. This is one of my goals in doing the show, but the commenter also mentioned that it has a lack of ethnic or racial diversity. And this is certainly the case. I had, I think, one Chinese, one Japanese, and one scientist of Indian heritage, but it hasn't been, I think, sufficiently diverse in on those kinds of areas. So I'm going to be making more of an effort to try and reach out to increase the diversity in other areas besides just gender. And finally, just a quick note on what's coming up on the show. You've probably been hearing me whinging in these intros for a while now about what's happening to funding in the U.S. for science policy and science research, in particular in climate. But I'm not a policy person. I'm not a specialist in these areas. So for the next show, which shouldn't be too long from now, I'll be interviewing Gretchen Goldman from the Union of Concerned Scientists, who actually is a specialist in science policy and studying how to better incorporate science in public decision-making processes. So that's coming up fairly soon. And, Jan and I sort of kick off right away talking about her time in East Germany. Here it is, me talking with Yana Selman from CICERO. So you were born in around 1978. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989. You grew up in the former Eastern Germany. And I think that the propaganda that I would have received at the time when I would have been, also a young person, was that life in Eastern Germany, must have been terrible, living in a communist totalitarian regime. What was your experience like? Did it seem to you like there was something amiss in society, or did it seem like just sort of like a normal, happy childhood to you at the time?
Yes. So since I was not even a teenager until the wall came down, I really perceived my childhood in the Eastern German period as a very pleasant experience. So I have no negative experience to tell you, because I had, it was really safe.
Not even one?
No, I mean, of course, as a child, you have, you have up and downs as well. But I, in the sense of growing up in a country and being incorporated in the society there, I mean, it was a very safe and happy childhood. I didn't miss anything. Of course, I know that if I had been living longer in East Germany or under this kind of government, basically my education and my career path would have been different because of the way we were not allowed to travel, or the way that education or what kind of profession you were going to learn was kind of was regulated. So I would have had a different life and career path if the East German regime would have continued. But since I only lived there until I was 11 years, I had a really nice childhood.
You didn't feel like the government was suppressing your activities as an 11-year-old?
No, exactly. No, exactly. It was, of course, I mean, now looking back, we had several things in school that you don't have in, you wouldn't have in a Western German school. Like we had like these parades and these uniforms with the like being a young pioneer, it was called.
So you actually were a young pioneer. My younger brother said that one of his history teachers when he was in high school ironically had a Young Pioneers Club.
Yes, I was a young pioneer.
He'll be thrilled to know that I actually talked. What is it? So did that just mean that you were, as you say, wearing uniforms on certain occasions and engaging in kind of organized nationalistic promotion parades and that kind of stuff?
Yes, or exactly.
Something else? When you talk with your parents now and they recollect on their careers as professionals, your mother was a teacher, your father was a civil engineer. Did they experience these kinds of constraints on what they could do in their careers? In other words, once the wall fell, did they have the opportunity to do things professionally that they couldn't have done and wanted to do previously?
Well, I would phrase it a bit different, because when the wall came down, they had, at least my dad had to change his profession, because he was working as a civil engineer in a governmental or in a state institute for construction or for building regulations. So that was closed down. So he actually had to change his job.
But why was it closed down? They just saw there was no need for it, or they had competition from the West? What happened?
I actually don't know why it got, but most, I don't know why it got closed down, or it changed maybe in the way, or it was more, it was not needed anymore. I have not, because I think what he did is in principle, what this institution did is they planned how houses should look like. So that's why in the East Germany, all the houses were kind of looking the same. They were these kind of...
Oh, so he's to blame for that.
No, but you know, you had similar furniture. You had, of course, you could choose three types of different furniture and three types of different townhouses or apartment buildings. But I don't think that was needed anymore after the wall came down.
Well, I guess that was part of the idea of having a flat society where you wouldn't have these vast inequities and lifestyle, and part of that, one way you could achieve that would be to regulate furnishings and architectural
design. Exactly, and this institution was doing that. So that was, of course, closed down after the war came down.
But your mom taught, as I understand it, she actually taught construction and building techniques. Did she continue on with the same work?
She continued with the same work, but she had to switch schools because there was like also some changes in school locations, and so she had then a longer way to work, because then she had to go by car because the school was placed in a different city. So she had to change the location while we were still living in these East German conditions. My parents walked to work because we lived close to where they were working, and everything was like, it was more localized. It was really, I mean, I walked to school, they walked to work, and it was really safe and a nice small community. Nice, but then after the wall came down, for a lot of the neighbors, the job situation changed dramatically. Some got unemployed. Some had really steep careers, earning a lot of money. Some just reoriented and had a similar like income or like comparable societal level. You notice that just in the years after the wall came down, in the next 5 years, you notice really how the neighbors split in terms of their wealth and of their careers and of their societal level. So it wasn't anymore this community feeling. It was more of envy and looking at the neighbor. Oh, he now got a BMW. Oh my God, and I can only afford an Opel. Or, you know,
Mad Men is a show about advertising executives in the 1950s and 60s, and there's a great line in which the main character is talking about happiness. And he says that happiness is the moment before you need more happiness. And this is the foundational principle of capitalism, about being on the hedonic ladder. And immediately when you acquire something, you immediately want the next thing above that thing, like moving from an Opel to a BMW. And it sounds like your entire community was just on a crash course in this transition from a flatter communist economy and value system towards a capitalist value and incentive system. Once your parents had either shifted their location or their careers, did this, I mean, I can imagine it causing a fairly big change in your own personal psyche. Did they experience difficulties in the sort of long-term adjustment process and societal change?
Well, my parents were in that sense lucky, or we had, for us, the conditions got better. So because both of my parents still had jobs, so conditions got better because my parents finally, they got to travel where they wanted to go. They got to buy the clothes and furniture and whatever they wanted to buy, and they had the necessary income to do so. So it was, of course, for us, we were happy, or for my parents, because, I mean, I didn't miss all these things that then were available to us after the war came down. But my parents, of course, they knew what is out there, and they probably missed a lot of things. And finally, they were able to buy or do things that they missed before, but they only were able to do so because they had jobs and the necessary or the income. And others, like our neighbors, right, for instance, they didn't have jobs after the war came down.
So your mother, in addition to having what from a Western society would be an unusual role of teaching, construction, was also a mother in East Germany. And I'm wondering what it was like raising children at the time in the previous Eastern Germany. What kind of support did the communist society provide? And then if you compare that to, you know, what you've seen in other countries like Canada, the US, and what you experience now in Norway, what is it like across that span of countries and political systems in terms of support for women and your ability to pursue a career in high level science while still having the kind of family you would like to have?
Yes, I think in East Germany, or how I was raised by my mother, my perception of a mother was always that the mother also works the same as a man, as the father. So it was my mother only interrupted her career for 3 months, for me having me and nursing me in the first 3 months. Mm-hmm. But then I was taken to a nursery.
But was it a state supported nursery, or was it a private nursery?
No, and the East German government was really good in having enough and a lot of nurseries and childcare places available to enable every woman to go to work and not interrupt their working career or working conditions for a long time. So this is something that I found very, that I was used to when I grew up. I was used to every woman is working full time.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was not a lot of women, or I don't even know any woman that stayed at home to take care of the children. But when East Germany, when the wall came down, and then we merged with West Germany, it really became apparent how different societies are in treating like childcare or raising children, and the difference between men and women. And so in Western Germany, it was much more common that the woman stayed at home, took care of the children, and that the father earned the money.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and there was not as many childcare establishments or facilities in Western Germany. And it took a while. And not all, I mean, it was not that the good thing about the East German system with all the childcare was taken up by the West German society. Immediately, it took a very long time and a lot of political will and to get also West Germany up to a level that every woman that wants to work has a childcare place available. And so this is a really also the thinking, for instance, in Bavaria, it was really, or the people, the women in East Germany that were working all the time and bringing the kids to nursery or daycare were like, oh my God, what do you do to your children? Because the perception there was, oh, you can only raise children when you stay at home for the first 3 years at least. Mm-hmm. And so there was a complete different perception of how you should raise or how the women and men should pursue a career and work and who should earn the money. In my own, now that I have my own children I started my with having children in Germany, where of course we had childcare place after 1 year, but then we moved to Canada and it was super difficult and super expensive to have a childcare place. But since we were there on fellowships, I really wanted to work. So it was really important for me to find a childcare place, and it was really difficult. And we spent almost half of our fellowship just to pay for the childcare. And then when we had two children, it was almost impossible to. It was good that we had a very high German fellowship that was covering the childcare expenses. So that enabled us to work and have our children in the childcare, which is not necessarily the case for if you only have two postdoc salaries in Canada. People really think about family planning there in terms of, can I afford a second child? Whereas now the Norwegian example is almost like East Germany. It's but even better because you do have the opportunity to take off a whole year paid leave, and after this year you're sure that you will get a childcare place. So every woman is just there. So I mean, if you look
just
around,
totally mellow and chill, no one's stressed out.
Yes, exactly. And it's the attitude towards having children. At least everyone has at least two children. There's not, you hardly find any one child family. And a lot of families have three children because it's not perceived as a very negative thing for your career to have a child, because it's accepted by your boss, it's accepted by your colleagues, that eventually you go on maternity leave. And that can be once, twice, three times.
Having a family, if you want to have a family, should be a normal part of having a professional career, not a serious impediment to doing it, which is, I mean, the default now is that if you want to have a child and succeed in academia in the US, you just sort of expect that it's going to be hard, which is, it's abysmal.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be that hard, because it can be different, like in Norway. But Norway is an extremely rich country, so they have a lot of support.
Yeah, they have enormous oil income. They have a small and relatively homogenous population, and high taxes, like all of which makes it easier. I would guess, than it would.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly, but it's what the government sets the priorities to.
Yeah, I mean, why if that's what you're going to get from having higher taxes, if you're going to get good education, fantastic maternity care, I would be fine with paying more than half of my income in taxes. That'd be great. I would much rather do that than be funding the world's largest military, for example.
Yeah. Exactly. And that, I mean, just I think that also contributes to the fact that Just the other day, I saw the report on the happiness indicator.
Oh, don't remind me. You're going to rub it in, aren't you?
Ranks as the happiest country in the world. And I think the reason is because you are so well taken care of.
Yeah. And how is that a bad thing? I really have never understood the visceral reaction against Scandinavian countries that many Americans have. I think, I mean, the things that you get for your taxes are pretty great.
Yes.
You've lived in many, many locations, but in high school, when German reunification would have already happened, you spent some time as an exchange student in North Dakota. How did you end up there? And was that just a massive culture shock going to North Dakota from Central Germany?
No, actually, the thing was, I really wanted to use this opportunity to go abroad. And fortunately, my parents were open enough and wealthy enough to afford letting me do this. And then in my application to do that, I wrote, yes, I don't want to go to a state where it's too hot. So they sent me to North Dakota.
Good choice. Yeah, good choice.
I think because I had several criteria in the application, and they based their choice of, or they match it with the available host families.
Right.
And one point in my application was that I play the accordion.
Oh.
And my host dad in North Dakota, he was a very passionate accordion player.
Wait, was he passionate and bad or passionate and good?
He was brilliant. I mean, wow. He didn't even need notes. He just played by ear, and he was really good. And so I guess because I had that in my application that I'm playing the accordion, and I was not even half as good as him, and I didn't even practice the accordion. I don't know. And because I said I don't want to go in a really hot place, I think they put me in
the accordion cold weather. There's only one possible host family.
Yes, exactly. And so, but I actually, it gets really hot in North Dakota.
And absolutely. Summers are hot.
But at least in the wintertime, it gets really cold as well. And they have snow and a lot of wind. But in that sense, of course, it was a cultural shock because in Germany, I lived in a small city and it was more urban. And then in North Dakota, I lived on a farm outside of this little town, Wahpeton. And that was a complete different because I had to use the school bus to go to school.
Yeah.
My host mom drove me to school. So the real American life, you know, you never walked anywhere. I got picked up by the police one afternoon when I tried to walk home. And they were wondering, what is this girl walking on the street?
You can't walk in the streets.
Exactly. And it was so strange to me. Yes, but I also enjoyed it so much.
Just the space.
Yeah, just the American lifestyle was very interesting to me to experience as well. But I learned to appreciate a lot of things about the German lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So it's every country has its own advantages. And
I guess you didn't dislike the U.S. because you came back for some graduate studies at the State University of New York in Stony Brook around 2000, 2001. What drew you back to the States and to that particular location?
Well, there it was basically that we had a collaboration through the university with that particular university. Mm-hmm. And I could have chosen between Golden in Colorado,
right, sure,
and New York, basically. I was really keen on living close to a big city and experience New York. And also the campus is, of course, on Long Island, and it's an hour and a half train ride.
Oh, I didn't realize it was so close.
Yeah. So every weekend, you just, we hopped on the train.
Just party.
Exploring Manhattan. No, not partying, but exploring Manhattan and all these lovely things that you can experience in Manhattan. And at that time, I had a boyfriend who went then to Golden, Colorado. So I basically had both.
Oh,
so I did my studies in New York, but at the same time, I visited Colorado quite often.
But that, and that's more or less when you began working on geosciences. You continued on getting a master's in 2003 in Freiburg in what I think is called geoecology. What actually is geoecology, and what led you sort of to kind of continue in that vein of study?
Geoecology is a subject you can, I think, only study in a few universities in Germany. Mm-hmm. And what it basically entails is studying the Earth system. So it's Earth system science, getting to know all the spheres of the Earth system and studying the interaction between these spheres of the Earth system, including also the human aspect.
So not just studying atmospheric sciences, but atmospheric interactions with the ocean at the same time as you're looking at the human systems, which, you know, I guess places like UC Irvine or Stanford, you know, have Earth system science programs that are somewhat in that vein. But that seems like it was kind of at the beginning years of that idea as a graduate program. Was it just getting going in Germany at the time? And who were the people that were leading the development of those programs?
I think in Freiburg, where I studied geoecology, I was the second year or third year of this kind of subject, of course. But it had this kind of geoecology has existed for much longer in Bayreuth. I think Bayreuth, mm-hmm, in former Western Germany, was the place where it really started. And the different locations in Germany, you had a little bit different focus. Like, for instance, in Freiburg, since it is the technical university, Bergakademie, Freiburg, so it's a lot of geoscience, geology, and it's the oldest mining university, basically, in Europe.
Oh, it's a mining university. So, okay.
Yeah. The mining community. So that's the history from Freiburg. Our studies were more related to soil science, hydrology, more these earth-based spheres. That's why I choose Freiburg, because initially I wanted to study soil science, mm-hmm, because I found it so interesting, how so much things happening in the soil and so much things on top of the soil depend so much on the soil.
Yeah.
And so I was really fascinated by this interaction or by this, between soil and atmosphere and biosphere. And since Freiburg, the geoecology studies included one major field of soil science, I decided to go there. Whereas in Bayreuth or in other university, it was more the focus on either microbiology or environmental economics. So it was different. Each university that offers geoecology has a slightly different focus.
Well, you didn't stay with a focus on soil processes. You know, now you're working more on atmospheric extremes. What caused you to begin at least to diverge away or add on to your interest in soils?
In my master's, so in the bachelor, of course, we have a lot of all this groundwork to do, like physics, chemistry, mm-hmm, hydrology, and biology. And but then in the master's course, you can choose three specializations. And I had atmospheric science, soil science, and ecology. And because these were the three spheres that interested me the most. And then, of course, with a proper geoecology study, you need to do field work. So we did a lot of excursions in the summer or in the winter, going out in the fields, taking soil samples or doing transects for studying ecosystems. And I, doing all this semesters of doing field work, I really thought, actually, I don't want to do that. I want to sit at a computer, at a proper desk, at a very comfortable temperature, dry, and with a coffee readily available. So for me, I could not imagine doing my master's or my PhD thesis. At that time, I was thinking only about my master's. I really wanted to do my master's without doing any field work.
I mean, I think that's an incredibly important lesson to get fairly early on in your graduate work. And I think that a lot of people actually don't get that. And they go down a career path or an educational path in grad school that they really don't want to do. So yeah, congratulations. Was it at all difficult to extricate yourself from the field work, or could you just say, I don't want to do field work, I want to do computer work?
Yes. So at some point I decided that I don't want to have the field work on a regular basis.
Yeah. Like,
but I think another aspect that shaped the way I was then taking was one of my internships that I did at GeoMar in Kiel, mm-hmm. where they do ocean science, paleoclimate studies. And at that time, a researcher from the Max Planck Institute in Hamburg applied for a professorship at the University of Kiel, mm-hmm. and he gave his introduction lecture. And that person is called Mujib Latif.
Sure.
And during my internship, I listened to his lecture, and I was so fascinated by this person and the lecture he gave, and the topic of climate and climate change, that I really wanted to get in contact with this person, and I wanted to do my master or at least an internship at the Max Planck Institute with him, and that then turned out to be also an opportunity for my master's thesis. So I think that was also a critical point in my basically education and career path, that I met Mujib Latif and that he offered me to do an internship with him at the Max Planck Institute and then get the experience of what it means to do computer work.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the work they do at the Max Planck Institute is not something that I had learned or had experienced during my studies at the University of Freiburg. We hardly had ever touched a computer or needed a computer for our work, except of filling in Excel spreadsheets and doing some graphs, but it was no modeling in that sense.
Yeah.
Doing that internship at the Max Planck Institute in one of my master's years or semesters, that really...
It's just eye-opening, it sounds like.
Yes, it kind of gave me the idea or gave me the background and the necessary basis for making up my mind that this is the work I want to do. I really like this working with the computer, coding and looking into models and analyzing climate data and producing colorful plots and so that was basically why I was able to pursue this kind of career. Everyone in his or her studies, I would recommend to do as many as possible internships, because only that way you find out what you really like.
I mean, that's
and
interesting
what you don't like.
It doesn't. Internships do exist, but they're much less common and much less formalized in the U.S. graduate education system. It's the kind of thing where if you were in a graduate program and you said to your advisor, hey, I'd like to go and work with this scientist, she's doing great work, they might say, okay, fine, go for a couple of months. But there's no actual internship program. It sounds like there is something more like that in the German system. Is it still going on like that?
Well, I don't even remember if that was a formal requirement of our program, or if I just was...
You just did it, yeah.
Yeah, I've always thinking ahead and being very open and interested in a lot of things, and that's why I did it. But I remember that I think it must have been part of our program to at least spend a few weeks somewhere doing an internship, because I remember that my fellow students, the other students that I was working with, they also did internships at different, institutes, not where I did. I think that shaped their career as well. And I think that is one of the good things about the program in Freiburg, because it was a bit, because it's a technical university and it was really well structured, that this requirement of doing internship helped also the students to kind of realize what kind of job after the master degree they want to take.
So it sounds like it was more focused on building skills, and part of building skills is having a variety of experiences rather than necessarily getting what you might call like a book education.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So when I think about climate modeling, and I've only kind of been thinking about this recently, actually, I mean, you can do it in a variety of ways. You could be a person who is primarily responsible for implementing and developing and testing algorithms. You could be a person who's involved in, you know, running the models, or you can be a person who's more involved in analyzing the model output. I think it's kind of rare that you'd have some person who's excelling at all of those different areas, because it's such, they're all huge tasks on their own. When you initially got into this work and then through your PhD, did you find yourself becoming more or less interested in particular aspects of climate models?
Yes, well, I was always very interested in climate extremes. So since my master's, I was, when choosing my master thesis, I was really interested in looking into climate extremes in model data and observations and in connection with large-scale circulation and patterns. And this basically is the red thread through my career until now, that I focused on more or less on data analysis. And the main driving question was like, how well can models simulate extreme events from a global to a regional model, and how useful or how can we use it to look into future changes of climate extremes?
Maybe we can just back up a second, because I feel like the word extremes is conceptually simple. Everyone can say, oh my goodness, that was a huge rainstorm, or that was a massive heat wave. But where is the community now in their definition of what an extreme is? Or is this definition specific to specific questions and particular individuals or papers?
Well, the general characteristic of extreme is basically that it is a very rare event with a high impact. And that depends, of course, on the region and of the system or the person affected by an extreme event. So a heat wave, which we perceive as a heat wave here in Norway, which is maybe 30 degrees for 5 days, might not be perceived as a heat wave or something extreme event in Africa.
Sure, because they have different levels of societal adaptation and cultural expectations.
Exactly, and also they adapted to a completely different climate.
Does that mean that people typically just talk about percentiles, like the 99th percentile for the past 30 years would represent an extreme, or is there a different definition that's in use?
Well, there are various definitions for extremes, and I mean, using percentile is basically describing how rare an event is, because the higher the percentile, the less likely this kind of event is. I mean, if you're talking about return values, a 100-year event is something very rare compared to a 5-year event. And the percentiles are basically an expression of that. But a lot of people cannot think in percentiles or have very, I mean, they don't have any connection to what it means, a 99th percentile or a 100-year event.
Sure.
If you're not working in hydrology or building design or something.
Or a 4-sigma extreme or something like that.
Yes, exactly. But that's why this group of the WMO Commission for Climatology, they established this expert team on climate change detection and indices. And this team, many years ago, they tried to come up with a set of indices for climate extremes that are globally basically valid, and that describes some types of climatological features that capture different aspects of extremes. But they concentrate only on precipitation and temperature, and some of the examples of these indices are, for instance, consecutive dry days, which is an indicator that describes drought conditions, and there is, for instance, a warm spell indicator, and for instance, the hottest night in the year or the hottest day. And this, some of these indices really also have the climatology of the specific region as a basis, and some of them are just the absolute values of, for instance, the daily maximum temperature. And so they came up with this 27 indices, which are now heavily used. I mean, they were used in all these IPCC reports since, I think, this third assessment report. They were used to look into projection of climate extremes. They were used to gather a huge database globally to have these indices filled into a globally gridded data set so we can compare the models with an observational data set, because in a lot of areas we don't have observations of daily extremes or daily data. So they made an effort to do workshops in Africa, South America, to bring people together that bring daily data, which they are not allowed to release publicly, but they were able to calculate the indices, and these indices went in this database.
I see, yeah.
And so this was a huge effort of this expert team to generate these definitions for extremes and then also this according database. And now it's used very widely and globally, and particularly in my work contributed to the fifth assessment report.
If you think about what's been learned from that expert group, but also more broadly from the literature on climate extremes, what are some of the key findings that are the most important societally, let's say since pre-industrial conditions, 1750 to 1850, somewhere around there to modern? What are the ones that we can say have absolutely occurred over that time period? Going off to things that, you know, people suspect might have occurred, but the evidence is still rather equivocal or difficult to pin down.
With extremes, it's hard to say if we already have seen a change in, for instance, temperature extremes or in precipitation extremes, because of their definition of being rare, you need a long time series to really detect changes. But in recent years, it become more and more obvious that warming, the global warming, contributes to having more heat extremes, or some of the worst heat extremes were attributed, or heat waves were attributed to partly climate change. But I think what we often struggle with extremes is having sufficient data to do trend analysis.
Just because they're rare events, and therefore you don't have, even though you might have a continuous data stream from a gridded weather observation, you know, like the Hadley Center one or GIS or whatever it might be, that the presence of extremes by their very definition are rare. So you have this long tail distribution of few extremes, and then it's difficult to do a trend analysis on such a small number of events.
Yes, exactly. But we have methods and tools to look into that, to extrapolate from if you have only 50 years, but then we can fit the extreme value distribution, and then we can extrapolate to rarer events, but that entails some uncertainty. But the challenge with extremes is that we have a lack of observational data to really make clear statements about changes. So up to, but it, as climate warming intensifies and as we go further now into the future, we will have more and more data that, and already now in the last years, we have so many new sources like satellite data and other remote sensing data sets that we are more and more able to really make the analysis more robust. But in that sense, I mean, we see changes in climate extremes in the recent past, and the projections are clearly showing that if we continue with the level of greenhouse gas emissions that we are now doing it, we will run in serious trouble.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about one of your long-standing interests in extremes, which is changes in circulation. So, very broadly speaking, from the atmospheric side of it, there are two big factors that might affect the presence of extremes, and in particular precipitation. One is the thermodynamic effect, which is just the Clausius Clapeyron, the changes in atmospheric moisture holding that will occur in a warming climate. So you can have more water vapor in the air in a warmer climate. Therefore, you could potentially produce more extreme precipitation events. But then there are the much more interesting changes you see in circulation, things like changes in the position of the jet stream, the waviness of a jet stream, or the frequency and persistence of blocking events. How has our understanding of those kind of circulation changes developed, let's say over the past 5 years? And what do you think is the next thing that needs to happen to move understanding forward on circulation changes and their relationship to extremes?
Yeah, there's two things. One is our insights or our knowledge on circulation in itself, like in the position of the jet stream or the changes in, for instance, the poleward moving Hadley cell expansion due to warming and atmospheric blocking. So this is one field. But the other field is like, how does this relate to extremes on the surface, like, for instance, temperature, precipitation shift.
Right, right.
And it's really what I'm most interested in is the link, establishing a robust link between the circulation and the surface extremes in order to be able to better predict these occurrence of extremes. Because for a single event to happen, like a heat wave, for instance, you need certain conditions. You need, yeah, for instance, in Europe, you need atmospheric blocking to sit there and block any clouds. And then we have a lot of sun for a long period. And then the surface warms up and it's really likely to have a heat wave. But it's not the only factor that will help to establish a heat wave. It also is the soil feedback. So you cannot only explain an extreme event by just the circulation. That's really tricky, and what often is complicating our world, you know, if we want to predict an extreme event to happen.
Yeah.
It's the combination of these circulation large-scale features and then the local to regional feedback mechanisms.
Does that argue for simply having higher resolution models that have good land surface coupling run in an ensemble mode to try and get better predictions over sort of weeks to months about the occurrence of extremes?
I think we need a combination of high resolution models for the local phenomenon. But also these high-resolution models need to have information from the large scale. And if we drive a really high-resolved model with a very poor coarse-resolved global model,
yeah, right,
we will have a problem, because it will not really, for instance, with the example what we look at in one of my projects, looking at heavy precipitation events that are coming or that are caused by atmospheric river events, like where large amounts of precipitation of moisture are transported over the ocean, and when they hit the west coast of Norway, or similar phenomenon you have at the west coast of North America, when these large amounts of moisture that are transported in very narrow strips, that's why it's called rivers, in the atmosphere, and then they hit the coast, the mountains, then they dump all the precipitation on the ground, basically, and that causes heavy precipitation events in Norway and also flooding. So, in order to have this moisture being appropriately represented in the regional model that then downscales the precipitation that falls in Norway, we need a very good resolved global model that is driving the local, the regional downscaling model.
When you say a well-resolved global model, do you have a particular resolution in mind?
What we are at the moment, we are looking at a 25-kilometer EC Earth model, which is able to resolve, or you see, features of tropical hurricanes and tropical storms. And often these are the sources for these atmospheric rivers that then travel over, like that the origin is in the tropics by, for instance, a hurricane, and then there's extra tropical storms, and then they travel to the north. And then that's how they have all this moisture with them. And if you don't have a global model that resolves these tropical storms or extra tropical storms, then you won't have as much moisture being transported into the region of interest.
Yeah.
So you might most likely underestimate the amount of precipitation or water that is dumped on on your region?
I've been following the development of the impasse modeling scheme coming out of Los Alamos, which is this non-rectangular gridding system in which you can have extremely high resolution where you want it. For example, on the Gulf Stream. And I think I asked him at the time, well, I mean, shouldn't it theoretically be possible to have this dynamical mesh where you have this very high resolution sort of moving around dynamically so that if the Gulf Stream itself moves in position, then the high resolution part of the model would also move with the Gulf Stream. And it's also occurred to me that this kind of system could work in the atmosphere, where if you do have particular atmospheric rivers that are of interest, you could zoom in on those and not have these discontinuities between a global model and a regional model. And they basically just laughed at me and said, like, this was, yes, theoretically possible, but a long way off. In your own discussions, you and your colleagues in the field, is there any scope for that kind of an approach for extremes, or is that just numerically and computationally and conceptually not possible right now?
I think that would be the ideal case, to have a global model which is very high resolved and even higher resolved at the areas of your interest. And I think it is possible with the speed of computational development and resources we have. I think it is possible to, in the next maybe 10 years, to have these kind of high resolved models. But I think, and I know that the Max Planck Institute in Hamburg is also working on a model that is kind of differently designed than the traditional model. It has a different grid and a different way it is designed. And I think these are models that are the future. Most of the models that are now in place, the problem is they are based on very, very old Fortran code.
Yeah.
What you see from the CMIP 3 to the CMIP 5, there was most of the models didn't even increase much in the resolution because they didn't get the model to be stable, to run stably on a higher resolution. So they went back to the old resolution to at least have a stable simulation for this.
It wasn't a computing power issue. It was a numerical stability problem.
Yes, they didn't get the simulations to run in a stable condition, and then so that they had to switch back to the old resolution in order to be on time with the CMIP-5 simulations, and then that's why you have a lot of models that didn't increase in resolution from CMIP-3 to CMIP-5. I think we need to rethink how a climate model needs to be programmed or designed in order to make up speed and resolution. I think that is the thing of the future. We need to have more the IT professionals working with climate researchers in order to build a climate model that we can run on a very, very high resolution in a reasonable time, and not only like time slice experiments, but really like the runs transient, that we're doing now, transient experiments. That takes time because you cannot just reprogram a whole climate model and then let it go.
No.
Because you need to compare, you need to evaluate.
I mean, that's doing that is not on the level of doing the Manhattan Project, but it's, it's an enormous software engineering challenge. I've heard Mike Wehner make similar arguments and sort of saying that relative to the investments in computing power, the investments in IT are basically an order of magnitude underfunded and under-resourced. You've worked in Canada, you've worked in the US, you've worked all over Europe. Where do you see the most scope for getting that kind of support to push this kind of modeling forward?
Well, I think it's a question of how well the funding organizations work together with the researchers and see the need for spending the money or the resources in having collaborations between different disciplines like IT and climate.
I mean, I think it's not going to happen in the U.S. in the next 3 years and 8 months, I would say, at the very soonest. I mean, is there interest within the EU to do this kind of stuff?
As I said, I mean, the Max Planck Institute has now spent several years of building this new type of climate model. So there was the willingness of the funding agency to fund this kind of project. And now they're using these funds to build this new type of climate model. But as I said, it takes a few years until this is a functioning model. And then it needs a few more years to test it until it really can be used or replace maybe the old model. It needs larger efforts in money, even in like on the EU-wide basis,
yeah.
It could be an effort. But I think if there is modeling centers like the Max Planck Institute and there is visionary leaders, then things can happen.
You've worked, as we discussed, kind of all over the place. And I'm wondering, you know, we're talking about building new modeling systems. If you were to build your ideal scientific construct in terms of an organization or a university, what would you take, let's say, from Canada, the US, Germany, and Norway, and what would you leave behind? What do you think are the good parts of those systems, and what are the parts that might be impediments to getting good work done?
Yeah, I find in Norway I really like the research environment, because you, as an individual researcher, you can apply for fundings and you can build your projects, and it's you can do it on a basically just on a disciplinary topic or in an interdisciplinary topic, and you can build a group or build collaborations, and I find that very interesting or very nice for my own personal interest. But in Germany, what I find is it's a bit more difficult. They have a lot of funding for PhDs and postdocs, and then for junior professorships. But then it's really difficult to become a professor, mm-hmm. or getting a permanent position. And once you are in an institute, often how the funding structure is very hierarchical. So often only the professors or the directors of an institute can really apply for larger projects. And so as an individual postdoc or researcher at an institute, you usually don't have a permanent contract. And also you're not allowed to apply for these larger projects. So you're always depending on what kind of institute you work on, and if your professor or your director is leading or involved in some kind of larger project. So that's more hierarchically, and I don't, that's where I would not have been able to develop as much as I was now able to do in Norway with the funding and hierarchical structure it is here. But in the US or Canada, well, we left Canada because we were there when the former prime minister
yeah, you're right,
in charge, and that was really restrictive for science, or really limiting, and so that was not really the best atmosphere to do research in. But things have changed and improved now. But what I liked from working in Canada was basically the example that I experienced at the Pacific Climate Impact Consortium, the PCIC in
that's where Francis Wires works there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's more like, it's more a climate service institution than it is a research institute, but they're working, there are some really good researchers working there, but they are supported by a large IT department. Mm-hmm. So that's what I benefited a lot when I worked at the CCCMA in collaboration with the PCIC, that the IT support was really special, really outstanding, I would say. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. if I could build my own institute, I would have a large IT department supporting the researchers, and I would have not only climate scientists, I would have interdisciplinary units, basically, people working from different disciplines together. It's like we do here at CICERO. So I think this is a very fruitful ground to come up with good ideas.
Jana Selman has had some of the big advances recently in climate extremes, and also has a good ideas for building a fantasy university. Jana, thank you so much for the chat today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
That was my interview with Jana Selman from CICERO. Jana, thanks a lot for the chat. If you like the show and want to hear it as soon as you possibly can, you can subscribe to it on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. You'll get an email right away when the show is available. Show notes are available at forecastpod.org. You can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter at MWClimateSci. As always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests. I do appreciate all the iTunes reviews that have been coming in for whatever. The iTunes ranking system is so bizarre. There are climate podcasts that have literally one episode from 2007 that show up ahead of Forecast. So it's completely nonsensical, but I do really appreciate the feedback I've been getting on iTunes. That's been terrific. I'll talk to you soon with Gretchen Goldman on climate science policy.